three, two, one, zero. And we have a liftoff. The Skylab lifting off the pad now, moving up. Skylab has cleared the tower.
This is the Cosmosphere Podcast, episode 29, Skylab at 50, blazing the trail for the International Space Station, Artemis, and beyond. Welcome back, everyone. I am John Molnix. I'm a volunteer here at the Cosmosphere. And in today's episode, we've got the audio from the Coffee at the Cosmo that was celebrating the 50th anniversary of Skylab, America's first space station. We had some amazing guests for this Q&A panel. First up, who joined us in person, was Emily Carney, a spaceflight blogger and author, and also David Hitt, one of the authors of Homesteading Space, The Skylab Story, which we highly recommend you pick up a copy of. The Cosmosphere's gift shop has signed copies available, and these books make an excellent gift no matter what time of the year it is. But we are getting a little bit closer to Christmas with each passing month here now that it is July. So make sure you get your shopping done early and often at the Cosmosphere's gift shop. Joining us via Zoom, we had astronaut Jack Lausma and Mission Control Flight Director Milt Windler. Without any further delay, let's get into the Q&A for Skylab at 50.
I'm Mimi Meredith. I'm with the Cosmosphere, and I'm so glad to see such a great group for what I know is going to be a wonderful presentation this morning. Just to let you know, our delay, we do have Jack Lausma attempting to join us, but technology is not working in his favor today. So it's always nice for me to know when someone as brilliant as Jack Lausma can't make his computer work. It makes me feel a lot better about my world. We do have Milt Windler and with us three wonderful guests. I want to talk to you a little bit before I get too far into that about some of the things coming up at the Cosmosphere, all made possible through the wonderful support of our corporate partners. That's Evergy, Dillon's, Clayworks, KU School of Engineering, and RCB Bank. So we're grateful always to them for their consistent and constant support of all things good at the Cosmosphere. So we have a wonderful exhibit in the rotunda about Skylab. This 50th anniversary makes me feel a little old and makes me realize how fast time has gone. But it was fascinating then, and it's fascinating today to see how they initially created the conditions that could prove that we could have that long-term existence in space. So please make sure that you check out our Rotunda exhibit. And right by that exhibit, following this presentation, will be where David will be signing his books. If you haven't gotten one yet, they're available in the bookstore and great for gift giving. Get two copies, one for yourself and one for a gift. Then coming up in June, speaking of anniversaries, it's the 40th anniversary of Sally Ride's first mission. Isn't that amazing? I know. So we'll be celebrating that with an event that's free to members and a small fee to the public. The actual date is June 18th of Sally's mission, but our event will be on June 16th here at the Cosmosphere. Shannon Wetzel will be leading us through some history. And we'll also have the opportunity early in June to interview Steve Hawley about his reflections on Sally Ride. And that will be wonderful because I'm sure many of you know that Steve and Sally Ride were married for 5 years. So it's great that we have that connection to her legacy. So we have all that coming up. And today, everything that we are doing today is really possible because of John Molnix. He's amazing. He's amazing because he's a Cosmosphere volunteer, and we need more of those. So if you want to be amazing like John, just call us. We'll get you set up. Lickety-split. And the O'Connors. And we have several. Marty could testify to this because where did you go? How many years have you been a volunteer? 41. See? I know. Thank you. Exactly. It's the reason Marty is doing so well today is because the Cosmosphere has enriched all those years, right? So John's a volunteer. He's a wonderful writer. And he and Shannon collaborated on the copy that you'll see on the Skylab exhibit and the history there. He also was able to find some of the great photos that we have available that tell the great story of how life was led on the Skylab. In 2017, he launched a podcast. How many of you listen to podcasts? Yeah, I have just started. I'm so sorry that I'm confessing that to you guys. But now I'm driving long distances more frequently, and it's just such a great way to learn things. And so you have podcasters here today that have delivered great messages about space and space history. John has one that is dedicated to the Cosmosphere and another one called the Space Shot. So we're very grateful for what you've done with that. Also, he is an amazing artist through jewelry. So you didn't even put that in your bio, but it's just, you use your right and your left side of your brain. It's just amazing. So with no further ado, I'm going to turn it over to John, who was the one who wanted to make sure that we celebrated this in every way that we could without a major event. But this is a pretty great one, John. So thank you for putting it together. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I try to be an artist. I do what I can for that. Before we get started here today, I want to introduce everyone here in person. And then after that, we'll introduce our Zoom guests as well. And hopefully Jack can join us. But we will press on here. To my left is Emily Carney. She is a writer, a podcaster, and a historian. She's also a United States Navy veteran. She's the co-host of the podcast called Space and Things, which if you haven't listened to it, you should definitely check it out. It's a weekly podcast devoted to the exploration of space, covering the past, present, and future of spaceflight. And then to Emily's left is David Hitt. He's the co-author of two books, my favorite, and the one that really, I think, tells the story of Skylab the best is called Homesteading Space, the Skylab Story. And that was written with astronauts Owen Garriott and Joe Kerwin. He's also the author of Bold They Rise, which is the look at the space shuttle early years. David and Emily have both appeared in numerous documentaries on Skylab. Currently, David is working as a contractor at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center. He's been doing that since 2002. And he's proof that you can be a journalist and eventually get into engineering long term, as we were talking about last night. So that's pretty cool. He currently works for Jacobs as a systems engineer supporting payload integration for NASA's Space Launch System rocket. He's also the recipient of a NASA Silver Snoopy Award presented by the agency's astronaut office, which is a really cool honor. Joining us via Zoom, we can see Milt there. Milton Milt Windler is a retired NASA flight director, best known for his work as one of the four flight directors during Apollo 13. Milt began his NASA career in 1959 supporting Project Mercury. He also served as one of the flight directors during the Apollo program, supporting six lunar missions. After Apollo, Milt began work on the Space Shuttle program and Skylab, and he was also involved with the remote manipulator systems, so the robotic arm on the Space Shuttle, until his retirement from NASA in 1978. He, along with the four other Apollo 13 flight directors, were awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom for their work bringing the crew of Apollo 13 safely back to Earth. He's also the recipient of a NASA Exceptional Service Medal as well, which is a really cool honor. And then if we can get Jack to join, we have. Okay, perfect. Just got the confirmation from Mimi. Jack Lausma was the pilot for Skylab 3 from July 28th to September 25th, 1973. He was also the commander of STS-3, logging over 1,619 hours in space. Lausma also spent 11 hours on two spacewalks outside of Skylab, which would be one heck of a view. I'm a little bit jealous of that. He served as a backup docking module pilot of, for the United States crew on the Apollo Soyuz mission, which was completed successfully in July of 1975. So we've got that 50th anniversary coming up here soon as well. The three Skylab astronaut crews were awarded the 1973 Robert J. Collier Trophy for, quote, proving beyond question the value of man in future explorations of space and the production of data of benefit to all the people on Earth. So welcome, everyone, to the Cosmosphere.
Perfect.
And Jack, if you can unmute and turn on your camera for us. Give him a second here. There we go. We see you, sir.
Good. Finally made it.
Perfect.
Thank you to Mission Control there.
So before we open up to the Q&A, I'm going to do a very brief history of the Skylab program, trying to condense three human space flights and America's first station into a very short time was a challenge. So bear with me here. Skylab, the station, the orbital workshop, launched on May 14th, 1973 on NASA's last operational Saturn V rocket. A modified S-4B, which was the third stage of the Saturn V rocket, was converted into the massive Skylab station. The Skylab cluster included the orbital workshop where the astronauts lived and worked, the airlock module, the Apollo telescope mount, and the multiple docking adapter. To this day, we were talking about this last night during a barbecue. Skylab remains the largest single pressurized station in existence. So it was a pretty big spacecraft. During launch, however, things didn't go exactly to plan. A section of Skylab's micrometeoroid shield tore off the rocket about 63 seconds into the flight. This led to the eventual loss of one of the solar panels, which you had the picture of Skylab up earlier. But losing one of those solar panels and part of the micrometeoroid shield was a big problem for NASA. It meant that the station was low on power and was experiencing higher than normal temperatures, which it was not designed to handle. Skylab 2 was the first crewed mission to the station, and it was initially scheduled to launch just 24 hours after Skylab 1. NASA had to delay the launch of Skylab 2 by 10 days, and that gave engineers, flight controllers, and astronauts time to come up with the tools and procedures that were needed to repair the ailing space station. On May 25th, Skylab 2 launched with astronauts Pete Conrad, Paul Weitz, and Joe Kerwin. The crew was able to use the scientific airlock on Skylab, which was a small port on the side of the spacecraft, to deploy a parasol sun shield, which was able to protect the station from the intense radiation from the sun. They also conducted unprecedented extravehicular activities to free the stuck solar panel, which was damaged during the launch. Skylab then had enough power to operate, and they were able to operate their mission for 28 days before returning to Earth, having set the longest spaceflight duration to that date, which was about to be broken by the crew of Skylab 3. Skylab 3 launched on July 28th, 1973, with astronauts Alan Bean, Jack Lausma, and Owen Garriott. The crew conducted more EVAs and installed another sun shield. This twin pole design provided extra protection from the extreme heat of the sun. Skylab 3 astronauts also conducted Earth and solar observations, which further expanded our knowledge of our place in the solar system. Another cool objective of Skylab was the inclusion of the Skylab student project experiments, which was the first time that student designed experiments were flown in space. Currently on the ISS, they've been doing student experiments for basically the whole 20 years of the program, which is awesome. Skylab 3, the crew set another spaceflight duration record at 59 days, which was shortly broken later by the crew of Skylab 4, which was the final crewed mission to the station. It lifted off in November of 1973. Astronauts Jerry Carr, Bill Pogue, and Ed Gibson were an all-rookie crew, which was another first for NASA. They ended up spending 84 days in space, which was the longest mission of the Skylab program. And it wasn't broken until NASA astronauts stayed on the Mir station during the 1990s. The crew continued to gather astronomical and scientific data for analysis on Earth. They also had the good fortune of observing Comet Kohoutek. How many of you remember Comet Kohoutek? They were able to observe that from space, which was a really unique vantage point. The crew continued to set productivity records thanks to a plan to maximize crew efficiency while in orbit, which was devised between the crew and ground teams. And we'll talk about this in a little bit. There was no strike or mutiny on Skylab 4. We'll help dispel that myth a little bit later today. Skylab later re-entered Earth's atmosphere on July 11th, 1979. Initially, there were plans to try to boost the orbit of the station to prolong its life so it could be visited by the space shuttle. Sadly, that did not happen. And the rest, as they say, is history. So with that, we are going to open it up to the Q&A section. And I'm going to ask the first question here for Jack and Milt. Now that we're a half century out from Skylab, What do you think is the most lasting legacy of the program or the most important thing that was learned during the Skylab missions?
Well, I'll start with that. Hi, Jack. I haven't seen you in a while. I think that the big thing that came out of Skylab, which is no surprise to anybody, is it put to rest some of the myths that are around spaceflight and improved that the crew or humans could operate in orbit for extended periods of time, as has been shown in the space station we have now. So I watched the medical community go from saying you couldn't even swallow anything and you had to eat from tubes to having sit-down dinners and turkey and all that stuff. So we've come a long way.
And Jack, what about you?
Okay, I was looking for the volume here, but can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think Milt was right on. A lot of the medical aspects of being in space for a long time were unknown. And so we obviously contributed to that greatly as well. But I think on a more mechanical point of view, it enabled us to develop and build an international space station. Without the information that we got from Skylab, would have not been possible. Up until Skylab, our longest duration in flight had been 15 days with a Gemini space capsule, two guys on board eating, sleeping, wasting together in the size of a front of the seat of a Volkswagen Beetle for 15 days. And so we really didn't learn much about living in space for a long period of time, except medically, perhaps. So the Skylab was that interim step that was required in order to make the International Space Station that we have today. And so I think that's one of its greatest achievements in many ways. Mechanically, how do we make this thing so people can live and work in a large space and do it efficiently, get all the work done that's necessary. And so it helped us to understand how building living quarters and the working quarters and the experimental efforts. It taught us so much of mechanically how to build the International Space Station. I think that was probably one of its greatest achievement.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm going to kick it over to Emily and David here for the next set of questions. Go ahead.
All right. Can you all hear me okay? All right. So this is for both Milt and Jack. Is there a lesson from Skylab that you believe that is forgotten, that should have been learned, that has been forgotten over the years? And I'll just take the next one. Prior to the launch of the workshop, was there anything that you guys were nervous about or that you thought would be the biggest challenge of Skylab? And were you right to be concerned about it?
Well, I wasn't concerned before the launch about things. You expect the launch to go well. It's got a lot of efforts gone into it, a lot of technical work. And I don't think anybody ever thought that the micrometeor shield would rip off and we'd have the situation we did. But we've shown many times that we can surmount things like that. But I don't believe, personally, I don't think that we were worried about things and not all that surprised. You may be going to ask us later if we thought there was a time when we're going to have to give up on a mission, and I would say that's never happened. We don't go into missions thinking that we can't fulfill them. We have many ways that we can do alternate procedures, and a lot of real clever people on the ground supporting that are able to provide alternates. So as Cran said, failure is not an option. So you can get around explosions, but anything short of that, we worked around many times.
I don't think there were any surprises either. We were training for this for a couple of years. I did interrupt you, Milt. I hope not interrupting Milt. I finished. Did I interrupt you, Milt?
Yeah, I was done.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I don't think there were really any big surprises there because we studied this thing for so long in so many places with so many expert people, not only within the government and NASA and our colleagues, but out there were all the contractors that worked on this as well. So we had it pretty well covered in terms of expertise and questions and concerns. And I thought that when we launched, we were very well prepared. And we were also very well prepared, it turns out, for the anomalies that we occurred that we hadn't expected. So we were able to react in real time for those kinds of things for which we never practiced because we had all the experience that we needed for the things that were on the schedule. And so I thought from a point of view of the crew that we never had any questions. Once we saw the problem, we knew we were able to fix it because we had such a great preparation, such support from everywhere in the system.
That's fascinating. Thank you. Let's kick it over to David, I think, next.
All right. So I got called out recently by Rusty Schweikart. And for the audience, if folks don't know who Rusty was, he was an Apollo 9 astronaut, but he was part of the original astronaut team working Skylab, very involved in the development of Skylab. And so he was on Emily's podcast recently, and they were talking about that 10-day period after the launch of Skylab. Things went wrong, everything that had to be done to get it fixed. And Rusty's telling the story, and he says, you know, there was that book written about Skylab, and they totally left my story out. And it's in his defense, it's a fair complaint. I will 100% own that. You write a 500 and something page book. You can only cram so many stories into it. And if it had been 600 and something pages, he might have been in there. But for Milton Jack, other than Rusty, who are some folks whose stories don't get told the way they should? You know, 50 years later, who are the forgotten heroes? Tell me a story about somebody that maybe deserves more recognition that doesn't get talked about as much as they should.
That's very hard to do. People work for a long time. A guy that always comes to my mind is Craig Starosinich. He was an ECOM on Skylab. He was on my team. And the ECOM is a guy that looks at the power supplies and the electrical systems. And after we launched and had to go into the standby wait mode, we had to fly in a real strange orbit that was as good as it could be for power and as good as it could be for thermal. Because if we went to the place that was good for getting the solar radiation, it made its Skylab too hot. And if we went to the place where it cooled down, we couldn't get enough power to the solar arrays. So we were in a strange attitude that was not stable at all. And we had to monitor that very carefully. And Craig, as the ECOM, was able to tell more about the attitude than maybe the guidance and navigation people. And one night, Craig was saying, hey, we're starting to ripple off power supplies here. We're probably in a strange attitude. And, I mean, we're probably not in the right attitude. We're not stable, and we're about to fall off this knife edge. And so we had to crank up the attitude control system and restabilize the Skylab, which we did. And I don't think very many people even knew that happened. And I thought Craig was one example of a guy going beyond his what you might expect from his background, and was able to keep us from getting into a serious situation. So his name is always, plus the fact that Starosinich is not exactly flow off your tongue real easy either. But anyway, he was a real good technical guy and a nice man too.
One of the personnel stories that I think of, everybody I thought during the Skylab preparation excelled, whether in flight control or mechanics or whoever they were. We had great support from everybody. I mean, we had great confidence in what they were doing and the fact that they're going to perform well while we're in space. But there's one story that comes out that is somewhat humorous, and I'll relate it here. In the early days at the Johnson Space Center, we didn't have much in the way of neutral buoyancy training. In fact, we had one small pool we could put a command module in and learn how to get out of it when it was upside down. And then we got a larger pool to work in as well, but nothing like we got now. At the Johnson Space Center, we were a little shorthanded on neutral buoyancy training, so we would go over to Huntsville to do some of that. Werner von Braun over there had always wanted to get more astronauts come live in Huntsville, and so perhaps he was trying to tempt us by making this huge water tank to get almost all the whole Skylab in. Hopefully astronauts can come there and live and train in it. Unfortunately for him, we decided we would just fly there with our T-38s and train in it for a few days and go back home. And so that's what we did. We had a huge neutral buoyancy tank trainer for the Skylab in Huntsville, and that's what we did. Often, however, during noon hours, Werner von Braun would invite us up to his office for lunch with a couple of his comrades from Germany. And so while we were there, we got to know him quite well, and he was very interested in how our training was going and so forth. And he wanted to talk about that, but we wanted to change the discussion, and we'd like to talk to him about more about his life in Germany. And so while they were asking questions about Skylab, we were asking questions about Pena Mundi and the V-2 rockets. And then we thought that was very interesting, but we never got a chance to live permanently in Huntsville, but we did remember him as being one of the greats in the Skylab program. That's about the end of the story, or as far as I'm concerned. Everybody, I thought, in the Johnson Space Center, all through NASA, wherever it was, and we trained at several centers for several reasons, and in all our relative contractors as well, they were also very supportive. And I don't think there was any anything stone left unturned, and all of our friends were thought of as friends there, not only professionally but as personally as well.
And I think that theme kind of opens up for one of the questions that we're going to ask here next is just the effort from everyone that was involved. I don't know if Emily or David, if you want to ask the next one here.
Yeah, for Jack in particular, this year we'll see a NASA astronaut cross the one continuous year in space mark for the first time. Would you wanted to have stayed in orbit for a full year? And what would an ideal duration have been given, you know, if you'd had a say in it?
That for me?
Yes.
Well, we stayed for 2 months. And actually, at the time we were staying for 2 months, the third flight was also scheduled for about 2 months, 56 days. They were scheduled the first 28 days and then 256 days. So when we left, the whole Skylab was configured for that. It was not configured for a longer mission than 256 days. So we got to the point of about 45 days or so on our mission. And we thought about the fact that the next mission was going to be only 56 days. So we thought we would go for a record. And so we made the request to stay for a few more weeks after 56 days so that we could be the longest days in space. And that was thought about on the ground, but not very thoroughly, I think. Excuse me. So we were prepared to stay that long and wanted to. We would have been well supplied as far as we could be concerned. But after we were there for another week or two, we were told that we were going to come back after 56 days. So we lost that request to be staying the longest flight, but we were ready to stay for 3 months if necessary. So we were sad that we were turned down, but when we finally came home, we were satisfied. We also had a successful mission. We've accomplished all our achieved all our goals, and we're very satisfied with that. But we could have stayed longer, and we wanted to just so we could be the longest. But that was eclipsed by our buddies on the third flight, and done very well by them.
Okay.
Jack, you would have run out of sugar cookies if you had to go that long a mission. He was our champion sugar cookie eater.
On a schedule and use everything up that was necessary, and they were really necessary.
I think we've still got some of those sugar cookies downstairs in the hall of space, but I don't know if I'd want to eat those at this point.
So the next question is for Milt. So Skylab, as many of us know, suffered some really significant injuries during its launch. So what was the mood like in the Moker during that time? And did you and your team think, you know, the space station could be salvaged?
Yeah, that's an interesting term you use, injuries. I read that, and I don't think I've ever seen that in a space flight before that wasn't applied to a crew, but I mean, personally, but no, we don't think that way. When things happen, we assume that we can fix them, and we do. And so nobody ever thought, I don't think, that we couldn't get around whatever the problem was, even the change in the power supply by losing part of the Skylab solar cells wing. So we just don't think that way, and nobody ever said that.
And then David's got a follow-up question on that for Jack.
So a few weeks before the launch of Skylab, there was a meeting at Marshall Space Flight Center where they talked about, what do we do if something goes wrong on the outside of the workshop? They met for a while. They talked about it. They finally decided there's no contingency plan. If something goes wrong on the outside of the workshop, there's nothing you can do about it. But that's okay, because there's really nothing out there that could break. Like, we feel that the odds of something going wrong on the outside of the workshop are low enough that we feel okay that there's no contingency plan. Skylab was designed for spacewalks, but it was designed for spacewalks up to the top of the telescope and back. There are handholds, rails, everything to get you from point A to point B, but nothing if you wanted to get to point C or point D. So that meeting where they said, we feel like there's nothing that could go wrong, was sort of the, God himself could not sink this ship moment for the Skylab program. They launched Skylab. Sure enough, during ascent, something goes wrong on the outside of the workshop. So this thing that they had just had a meeting to decide that there was no way on Earth an astronaut could do, they decided we're going to make the astronauts do it anyway. So the first crew had to do a spacewalk to the outside of the, to fix something on the outside of the workshop to free the solar array panels. Second crew, Jack's crew, had to do a spacewalk to install a new sun shield on the outside of the workshop. So Jack, tell us about what it was like going on an EVA, going on a spacewalk to fix Skylab, in a way that Skylab was kind of aggressively designed for you to not be able to do.
Well, we trained for every possible emergency, I guess. And we had trained underwater, of course, a lot. And we didn't think there was probably anything we couldn't do as long as we knew what to do, we had the equipment. And so we knew beforehand that we were going to have to put this shade over the parasol. And that, of course, was invented at Marshall Space Flight Center. And we went over there and watered their water tank and practiced for that. And that seemed like to be a doable thing. And there were a couple of things that were a little different. We had to take along some foot restraints, of course, to install on the outside. And then we had this big bag full of covering, which was fabricated out of several pieces and fastened together with some kind of an adhesive put in the bag. And so I took those out to do that job. And I had this big bag of material at my feet. And Owen stood down by the airlock and put together these flagpoles. And each flagpole was made out of 11 5-foot pieces and had a rope on it. And so as the pole got longer, he slid it out to me, and I finally got to the end of it. And so here I am out on the end of the Skylab with this 55-foot pole, very thin, but you could fight, it's a long, long fishing pole, is what it seemed like. Put those two in my structure by my feet. And then I got this big bag out of this big shade out of the bag, and I had to unfold it. It was all folded up neatly. You can see the folds as you look at the picture, even from months later in the pictures. And so I unfolded this thing, and it got to be bigger and bigger. And I hooked the ends of it to the flagpoles and started to run them up the pole. And as I looked at, I couldn't see up, but I could see in front of me, but I noticed in front of me the poles were getting, instead of in a V, they were bringing themselves together. And so something was wrong. So I looked up, and here's this big wad of stuff. All of the pieces that had been glued together, the when it was packed, the adhesive had not fully cured. And so the folds were stuck together. So I had to bring this big fold of material back over my head and separate it all out hand by hand, all of those folds to make sure they were not glued together. And then I had to somehow hook it together again to run it up the pole. And so I was able to do that. And then I had to also on the corners next to me, somehow we had to square this thing up. So the big long lanyards that I had to take to float back to the corners of the Apollo telescope mount and hook them up and square this thing up. And then laid it down over the top of the parasol and fastened it. And pictures have been taken of it later. As in fact, the picture of the Skylab that we saw on the program coming up showed these creases, and it showed it had turned brown in the sunlight, except for a very narrow area that remained white. That's apparently a place that I had forgotten or didn't get separated and didn't see as much sunshine, and so it remained white. But that's the end of the story. That worked very well. It kept us cool for all of our mission and all the rest of the third mission as well. One other EVA that we did that's not been talked about, but which was very unplanned, was we had to put out a rate gyro six pack, or not the big gyros, but the small rate gyros came in a small package, had to be replaced. And so they sent up a replacement canister full of those, about the size of a little bread box, I guess you might say, and had to be hooked on the outside or inside, but it had to be hooked up electrically with cables to some electrical spots out alongside of the Skylab. And this had never been planned. So there was a long cable about, I think it was about 26 feet long. It was in a V fashion. It had an extension out about halfway down, about 10 feet or so. And so I had to find the junction box on the launch on the side of the Skylab. There was no handholds, no feet restraints, just a box with about 8 Canon plugs in it that I could not release with my hand, but they knew what I was going to have to do this. So they made me a special set of pliers that I could unscrew two connectors that I had to make. And so I was able to do that somehow by wedging myself in there between the spacecraft and this box and get that job done. But that also then cured the rate gyro six-pack problem. So that was one of the EVAs that was less heralded, but it was less well prepared for as well. And so we got to the point where we thought there was nothing we could not do. And there was nothing that we could not do in the future if we had to. So we were very optimistic all the time we were up there. And doing a spacewalk was just amazing. You know, when you're inside the spacecraft, you watch the world go by. And you go around the world every hour and a half. Our track was over the ground at 50 degrees north latitude and 50 degrees south latitude. So we can cover with our Earth looking instruments the northern border of the United States. And so we never got tired of looking out the window at the world go by. And if you were really looking ahead, you could save your freeze-dried strawberries from breakfast in the morning and unfreeze them at night and thaw them out and have an ice cream Sunday. You're looking out the window and watch the world go by. But when we were watching the world go by from the inside, it was kind of like being in a railroad car. You could see everything go by quite quickly, but you couldn't see a whole lot of it. And when you're outside doing a spacewalk, it was just like being on top of the world, being on the front end of the locomotive and steaming down the track, because you could see 360 degrees for 800 miles. And it was just like being on the front end of the locomotive. I remember being out on the spacewalk one that time, and I was at the end of the tether about 55 feet out there, and I was on the ATM hanging on by 1 foot, getting my job done. And we went into the darkness, and the troops down below did not turn on the lights outside, so I hear them in total darkness almost, and I'm somewhere over the Pacific, so there's no light on the ground. And see a myriad of stars. You can see about five times as many stars at night out there, because there's no interference with atmosphere and the stars don't twinkle. Here I'm on this thing going around the world at 18,000 miles an hour and hanging on by 1 foot, and it's just me and the stars and God out there in blackness. That's a feeling that I never got rid of. And one of the most exciting experiences and memorial experiences that I could have. And so I think probably doing spacewalks was one of those kinds of things that we enjoyed the most. And we did see a lot of the world, because we were at these high inclination orbits. And every time we went around the world, we were going over a different ground track and seeing the world from their perspective every time we went, and identifying places we knew and some we didn't. But it was you could see you could see the Earth very easily. Of course, we could see the tans of the deserts and the mountains and the oceans, the blues of the oceans and the white of the skies and the clouds and the beauty of the Earth. And I just never got tired of looking out as we went around the world and seeing it in a way that we could.
So Skylab performed a lot of experiments, many of his experiments in three different areas, medical, solar physics, and of course, Earth observation. So what is the legacy of you've discussed looking down at Earth during your EVAs, but what is the legacy of the Earth observations performed during Skylab, and how did they contribute to ongoing environmental science, such as Landsat and things like that?
Is that for me?
And this is for Jack. Yeah, for Jack.
Yeah, it was not only a great experience to see the Earth visually, and we never got tired of looking out the window and took every opportunity we could. The crews that are up there now have this cupola, and it's like being in the control station of an airport. You see everywhere. And I claim that as my idea for addition to the proposal, as a matter of fact, and I've never heard anybody refute the claim that the gondola that is used the cupola now as a result of our experiences from watching the Earth from Skylab and the need to see in every direction. And tell me the question you asked me again. I lost track of it. What were the contributions to the Earth resources?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had Earth resources experiments. We had six different kinds of Earth looking experiments. And one thing you need to know, of course, is we had to upset the the orientation of the spacecraft in order to do this, because we wanted this solar panels to be looking at the sun at every orbit so we could have our electricity available. We had no batteries. We're depending on the sun for all of our electricity, and we could go only three orbits around the Earth without looking at the sun before we had to look at the sun again to get our electricity back. So all of our Earth-looking experiments interrupted that solar viewing, and we were pointed at the Earth with our lower-looking axis going around in what you might think of as an outside loop looking at the Earth below. And I related about how we looked at it visually and what we saw and how we appreciated that. But our six experiments were all trained at looking for certain kinds of things on the Earth. And we were trying to understand the Earth better agriculturally as well as physically in other ways. And so we had, I think, about 30 different sites to view, whether they were deserts or mountains or oceans or cloud formations. We were using our instruments on board to look at them very carefully. And all of our sites were located in the United States or other friendly territories. We were forbidden to look at any sites in China or Russia. And later on, as the program loosened up, we were able to, after the Apollo-Soyuz mission, we were unfettered in what we could look at going around the world, and we looked at it visually. Looked at it visually in different ways. Anyhow, the Earth Resource Experiments had six different kind of telescopes or receivers to be turned on and off at certain points over the ground, and these were very well controlled points. Had to do with agriculture or forestry or freshwater or mountainous or other kinds of important ground resources. And so we had about 50 sites, it seems like to me, as I recall, maybe it was 30, something like that, that we had to be able to identify before we flew over to them and turned on our instruments. And so they were located all over. So one weekend I took a T-38 and flew over all of them, of trying to locate them with the eye, see what they were near, so that we could have some precursors as we approached them with our telescopes looking forward in space. And as we went over them, then we would lock onto them and take the data. And as we went over them, of course, we would have to turn them off and look for the next site. And we were given a program as to what to look for on the certain days that we dedicated to these Earth Resources Experiment Package, or EREP packages. And we came back with a lot of good data. Agriculture, for example, we were looking for crop development. We were looking to see what we could tell what the status of the crop formation was. Vegetation, it was, that we could tell if it needed more water, if it was dry, if it was spoiled. We could tell you what kind of crop it was and what its potential yield was going to be, whether it was something like wheat or potatoes or cotton or something like that, or whether we're looking at trees. We could determine which was a deciduous leaf falling tree, or one of which was coniferous and evergreen. We could tell you their status of growth and their health, and their status of a water supply. So we were able to do the kinds of things agricultural control agent might do on the ground. And at the same time that we were looking at these sites from space, we had agricultural agents looking on the ground, looking for the same things we were looking for, to determine whether or not our experiments, our telescopes, were going to be good enough to substitute for all of that groundwork that was done. And it turned out in the long run, as I recall, that most of your agricultural types of information that you get from your agricultural department, not much of it comes from our telescopic spaceborne microscopic telescopic information. So I think that our Earth Resources Experiment Package was equipment worked out very reliably. The procedures that we had to do them worked out good. And the ground sites that we were able to find were all very, very efficient. And so I think we contributed greatly to the ground management of our natural resources.
Thank you. I think we're going to do one more question each for Emily and David. So whoever wants to go next.
All right. So the next question is for Milt. Skylab 4 had workflow situations that ended up resulting in a long time myth about a strike or a mutiny occurring during that mission. So please tell us what really happened and how the crew successfully fulfilled their mission.
Well, it was a success. The problem was we did not appreciate the difference between the ground control people's experience and the crew's experience. We had, Jack just told you, he had 56 days, and we worked with another crew for 28 days. So the ground team was really, you might say, in the peak of condition. But probably don't appreciate people like myself and Noah Flum like that. When you first get up into space, you have a period of acclimation that you have to go, your body has to go through, and that varies with different people. I was looking back at some of the comments that the Skylab 4 crew had made, and apparently Ed Gibson, for some reason, had almost no problem getting acclimated, and Bill Pogue had quite a bit, and Jerry Carr was somewhere in the middle, and that's typical of crews. But if you go back and look at Apollo 8, for example, 8, Borman had a hard time adjusting to zero gravity. So we really did not take that enough into consideration enough when we were talking about what we were going to do. Unfortunately, the ground team kind of picked up where we had been when Jack's crew left the spacecraft and came home. And we started from there when we should have given the crew a time to get acclimated, the Apollo Skylab 4 crew, more time to get acclimated. And when you're flying an airplane, you want to feel like you're ahead of the machine. For a lot of people, it requires a flight or two to do that. And if you don't fly often enough, the first time you get back in it, you feel like you're not sure of things. And after one flight, maybe or two, you get ahead of the situation and you feel a lot more comfortable. And we did not give them the amount of time that they needed to get up to that comfort thing. By the time the flight was over, they were doing stuff that along the same kind of way that Jack's team did. So that was a problem, and it was outlawed for not really anticipating this. And of course, no red-blooded astronaut is going to admit that he can't do something. So the crew were reluctant to tell us their situation. They did talk to Deke about it, and we finally gave them some more time, and things worked out. But there was no mutiny as such, and by the time the mission was over, we had another ton of data.
All right, thank you. So for the audience, I want y'all to take a second to think about what life must have been for poor Milt,
words on adaptation.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
Yeah, let me say that. Milt covered it quite well. By the way, Milt, I just got back last night. That's why I'm so late here from Seattle and Boeing. And we had a Skylab rendezvous out there. And the lead man on that, of course, was Mel Hutchinson. And he wanted me, or was Hutchinson, he wanted me to pass along his best respects to Milt because they were people that really held the mission together. And it was good to rendezvous and had a Skylab presentations out there at the Boeing. Nevertheless, I guess the adaptation to being in Skylab was one of those things that it was a concern to begin with. And as we went up on our second mission, we felt a little slowed down the first few days, but we got it back together very quickly, I thought. And by the time we had come to 6 days, it was well on the sixth day we did the first EVA to put that shroud over the parasol. Seems like it was anyway. We adapted being in zero gravity very quickly after the first few days of adaptation. And in fact, we got very efficient. And it turns out that we started asking for more work to do. And as I recall, we ended up being more than 100% coverage of all of the work that we are planning to do. And that's actually where the Earth Observations Program was developed. And we asked for more work to do. And one of those jobs that we got to do was look at Earth observations that were cranked up from the ground in real time. And so we did that, and that was added to the future flights, not only through Skylab, but into the International Space Station as well. And so that was, we ended up, I believe, as being 125 or 50% greater work than we had anticipated. And we got very, very well adapted very quickly. And we wake up in the morning and get this ticker tape improvement to our additions to our Skylab. We had a teleprinter that we could use to update overnight or plan for the day. Sometimes the thing was 20 feet long, and I had to go and cut it up into pieces and hand every guy his part of it. And we'd go over that at breakfast and get to work. So we got all of our jobs done very quickly, very efficiently. And it was a result of a good coordination between the ground and the crew to make those kinds of things happen. Lots of people were involved in that kind of coordination. And I think we gave the last crew a little bit of disadvantage by being so efficient ourselves by the time we finished. But if we were to do it over again, I guess we'd do it at best the same way. And the fact that we asked for extended duration was, I guess, up to the realization that we had pretty much accomplished our goals. And one of the last things, though, I did, that we did have last 3 days without any particular great things to do on the flight plan. And after 56 days, we were able to stay for three more before we went over, be over the landing site. So we came up with a few stunts that we might do. It would help the next crew feel at home when they got there. So I found their clothes. We all had overcoats and T-shirts and trousers, all the same color, so forth. We didn't have any laundry up there, so we had each change of outer clothing, inner clothing every day, but outer clothing every 2 weeks. So I found their clothes. And I stuffed them full of trash bags. And I relocated them different places in the spacecraft so they'd feel there was company when they got there. And I put the first guy on the treadmill, and the other guy put him in the lower body negative pressure device. And the third guy, I wasn't allowed by NASA to tell him where I put him waste management compartment. But that's where they found the third guy passing securely with the safety belt. And so I'm hoping they felt as though they had company. They were ready to come and get to work with the crowd that was up there when they arrived. Never lose your sense of humor.
I think that would have freaked anybody out.
Did you notice, he said, see, we had worked with the crew on Skylab 3 and got to one pace. And so all this trouble with Skylab 4 was Jack's fault because they were so efficient. But by the time Jerry and his crew had got to a few days into the thing, when we gave them some time to catch up, while they got back to where they were, they did the same efficient job. But we just didn't allow them enough time to get started. And I would like to say something about Skylab. Skylab is probably maybe my favorite program. And the reason was because we delivered a product. When we were doing Apollo, we were just going up there to the moon and landing and getting a few samples and coming back. And that was the mission. And in a sense, we didn't want the scientific people or anybody else bothering us. And we just wanted to get up there and successfully land and successfully come back. But Skylab, we contracted to deliver a product. We had these four different areas that they've been talking about. We had the medical experiments. We had the investigations of the sun on the ATM Apollo telescope mount. We had the Earth resources, and we had a miscellaneous. And we had divided the hours we had into several chunks, four different chunks, had a science czar that had within a discipline, say, take it Apollo telescope. Everybody there wanted their experiment to have all the time because they were interested in getting to be Nobel Prize winners. And the science czar was able to put priorities on that and give a nose why. Then we, on the ground team, were able to devise a plan where we could meet all those. And so, and I call that a product. And I think that was one of the things about the Skylab that appealed to me, was that we made a contract to take data and deliver data. And we did that for X number of months. So I like what we accomplished in Skylab very much.
Well, it's good to be talking to my neighbor and friends with for so many years as well. It's good to talk to my friends and from Friendswood. And also recently, just last night or day before, a few days, I was with our buddy out in the West Coast, and Ed Gibson was with me out there as well. And so we were able to ruminate quite a bit about the second and third flights. And Ed reminded me that when they got up there, they didn't have enough food, so they had to take some extra kind of rations along in order to survive for 3 months instead of just two. And so he asked me to pass his greetings along to you. We had a good reunion up in Seattle the last few days, and it's good to rendezvous with you on television today, and not only because we work together, but we live near each other back here in Friendswood. One other, I had some other stories in mind. I guess I couldn't remember them, but I probably should. But if we get a chance to chat again, perhaps we'll come with some even better and more interesting stories. Ed was talking about the fact that their rations were a whole lot different than ours. They had these bars they had to take along in order to stay longer, and they somehow survived on that extra chow.
Well, you're welcome here anytime. I'm speaking for myself, but we've got one more real quick question from David, and then we're going to open it up to a lightning round for Q&A from the audience and also via Zoom as well. So David, go ahead.
So first, I got to point out that the story that Jack is not telling y'all about the clothes at the end of the mission, he talked about taking the outer clothes and stuffing them for the third crew. But they get to day 56, they are out of underwear, right? Because they only have enough for their mission. So they realize the third crew has a whole supply of untouched underwear up there. So they call down to mission control to ask for permission to get a change of underwear. Mission control radios back up, says we got some good news and some bad news. The good news is you're approved for a change of underwear. The bad news is, Jack, you change with Owen. You change with Al. How do you change with Jack?
But, yeah, that's one of the better stories. I'm glad you brought it up.
But I wanted to follow up a little bit on something Milt was talking about just then. Yeah, poor old Milt. I mean, before they let him do Skylab, he had to suffer through several boring moon landings before they let him do the fun stuff. But, you know, I mean, the paradigm of a moon landing, you know, in mission control, there are things most days that are life and death for the crew, right? I mean, the launch is a big day. Translunar injection is a big day. Lunar orbit injection is a big day. Landing on the moon is a big day. Leaving the moon is a big day. Skylab, the reality is once you're up there, you know, day 42 may not be terribly different from day 28. So from a flight control perspective, kind of what were the big days for a Skylab mission, and what were some of your favorite missions from a flight control perspective?
Well, I didn't pick a one mission over another, but I guess big days would be from thinking about a packing and entry up, obviously, but would be the EVA days, and that was different. But you're right. One day is very much like another, but they're all interesting.
And then, Michelle, we've got some questions via Zoom, I think.
Hello.
There we go.
All right. We have a lot of questions from Zoom. We're going to take just a couple of them. What was the general morale feeling among the astronauts and flight controllers as the program transitioned from lunar exploration to space station science? That could be for either of you.
Well, I guess I just explained what I thought about it because, like I say, we were data gatherers and we were delivering a product, which was data in these four different areas. And we delivered data, tons of it. I sometimes wonder if they really looked at all of it yet, but probably they have.
Well, we had one guy in our flight that did it both. You know, we had Alan Bean went to the moon, second flight to the moon. And otherwise, Owen and I were rookies, so we didn't have the overlap. But we wished we had the opportunity to go to the moon and thought we might, but they canceled the last three flights. But we were very well occupied during that time. I worked on the lunar rover before we went and so forth, but we had responsibilities that could have pertained to the moon, but we never got there. But once we got into space and had some 60 experiments to do, we were very busy. We talked about the Earth and the medical and the solar experiments, but we had student experiments and we had a lot of mechanical type experiments that we had to do in materials processing and so forth. So we were very busy people up there doing things that never been done before. And even though I wished I'd had a chance to go to the moon, I had a lot of experience going on. I had a lot of work on the lunar module test and checkout for the first two flights of the lunar module. In fact, I think I have about 500 or 600 hours in the lunar module during test and checkout. That would have been very valuable. But I was really privileged to be able to go into Skylab. And Ed Gibson, I was with him in Seattle over the weekend last night, the last couple of days, and he asked me to send his regards to everybody during the student. He didn't have a chance to be involved. So Ed's greetings come to you from me.
Awesome. Thank you. We have one more question we'll take from Zoom. By the way, we have a lot of people on Zoom we have people from Germany, Alabama, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas. Okay, go on and on. This question is for Milt. When sitting at the console in the Moker, were there any functions of the spacecraft cluster that were controlled directly from the console, or were the consoles mostly for information?
Well, you don't mean my console, I don't think, but yes, they were. We operated a Skylab unmanned for the period of time between flights, between Apollo 2 and 3 and 3 and 4. And then after the crew left, we operated it unmanned for several months before it finally it re-entered. So there were controls. You couldn't do everything, but you could look at the do the solar observations for sure. And so that was, as Jack said earlier, it was designed really to look at the sun, and so it liked that attitude, and you could get power, the maximum power, and all of that. So it was easy to do that part. There were a lot of things we could not do because we didn't have people there to work on, but they could operate. We could operate it, not as controlled as the space station is and things these days, but we did.
I think we could be reminded too that there were possibilities that the Skylab is going to be used again. And so it was maintained from the ground up in orbit for a long, long time. And Fred Hayes and I were assigned to the third crew of the space shuttle to go and rescue it. And we worked on that for about a year. Fred then took the responsibility to get all the equipment on the space shuttle, like rendezvous radars and those kinds of things, so that we could find it. And I was assigned to help make sure that the rendezvous vehicle that was going to be docked with it was going to be flyable. It was about the size of a dump truck, I guess you might say, that we were going to launch out of the cargo bay. And it had a television on it. It had thrusters on it. And it had able to control it with a hand controller from inside the shuttle. It was going to rendezvous with the Skylab. We were going to offset about 2,000 feet from it, bounce this package out of the back of the space shuttle, and I was going to fly it remotely with the hand controllers and dock it with the space with the Skylab, just like they would have done with a land module, and then either fire the engines on it to get it to go higher and last longer and use again, or over a control spot so it would land in the ocean in a safe place. And so we were prepared to do that. But unfortunately, the shuttle schedule didn't meet up with the Skylab schedule, and we were called off, and the ground took control of the Skylab. We were able to put most of it into the Indian Ocean and a little bit of it into Western Australia. It didn't hurt anybody, but every once in a while, pieces of it would end up in America wanting to be autographed by the farmers who owned the parts of the spacecraft that made it into Australia. But the Skylab was intended to be used for a longer period of time, and unfortunately weren't ready with the space shuttle in order to get up there. And every day we would get up in the morning, we'd look at the position of the Skylab and the preparation of the space shuttle, and it turned out that the two didn't match. And one morning I got up, went to the office, and Fredo said, "Hey, Jack, got news for you. I'm decided to lay the space program here and fly and then work with the Grumman Aerospace." And so I was without a commander, and so I went over to see the folks in the office and said I needed someone to help me to get on with STS-3 And so I was put in command of SDS-3 and brought Gordon Fullerton along. We eventually flew, and the Skylab came in, landed in the water. And later on, Gordon and I flew a very successful 8-day space shuttle mission in SDS-3. But the Skylab idea and flight of Skylab didn't go away in the astronaut office even after the last mission. We watched it for a long time, hoping to get there and see it again ourselves. But we're disappointed we had a change. Okay. I'm finished. Are you?
Hi, my name is April
Ware. I don't think the microphone's on. Hold on one second. Yeah.
Try that. Here you go, April.
Thank you. Okay. Like I said, my name is April West. I'm from here in Hutchinson. My question is, this is for both of you. What was your favorite experiment to do up in the Skylab?
Yeah.
Is that for me?
Sure. Go ahead, Jack.
Favorite experiment. Well, I have to disappoint everybody, I guess, and make 59 people unhappy and one happy. All of the experiments were my favorite experiments. Because I was interested in making progress and getting the experiment, the people needed to go on the ground to further their careers. But one of the interesting ones that got a lot of publicity, I guess, and was everybody could refer to it, was the spider. And this was with the student experiment, and we had the spider. And the spider was going to come and live in space, and there was a certain kind of spider that would make a web and destroy it every day and make a new one. And it would do so by floating, of course, in the breeze or by gravity, floating somewhere else to spin its web. And so Arabella was the name of the spider. And Arabella had a small box about a foot and a half square, you know, about 4 inches deep. And it was a metal box, except the front part was two glass doors, which could open. And we could put Arabella in there and put her food supply in there every day as we needed to and without breaking her web and so forth. And so, you know, she came in a little container about the size of a shotgun shell, I guess you might say. And Owen Garriott was going to be the lead on this because he's a scientist on board. So Owen went to get the spider out of the command module. And Arabella's in there, and we had a backup, by the way, also to begin with. They can't remember her name, but she wasn't used. And he got this cartridge out, and took the cap off, and out floats Arabella. And her legs are going around. She's just floating, not knowing where to go, but she's obviously alive. So we don't know if she bit or not, but we didn't want to get her, grab a hold of her. So Owen called me over, and we with our hands, we kind of guided her over by pushing her one way and then the other, and finally getting her in the box and closing the doors. And then she's floating around inside, and nothing to hold on to, nothing. So she's there to give her something she can eat from. And so we check her out then the next morning, and she's still there floating a little bit, but she finally lands a corner. Now, she's supposed to spin a web every day, but she can't do it. So eventually, however, she's able to float herself from one corner to another and make a corner, whittle the web in a corner and destroy it every day. And then she was able to make 4 webs, one in each corner. And then she was able to make a web that connected those 4 webs. It wasn't a perfect web like she made on the ground, but she made the web. And so that was probably one of the most human interest type of experiments we had. If we tried to call out any of the others, and we'd irritate about 58 other people. So I guess it's best to say all experiments were our favorites, and we got them all done. And we got them done so rapidly that we were given more to do. And so gave the last group a lot of extra work to do as well. But we thought that the experimental groups that we worked with, Medical Earth, Sun, whoever they were, the other, we must have had about 60 experiments, and just not the 30 that we talked about in those three areas, but lots of others as well, flying the backpacks and just a host of them. Of the mechanical type experiments we had to do as well. So we thought we were very well prepared, that we had very good experimenters, very good experiments to do. And that's why we were able to get so much done, because we had such a great preparation from the ground to begin with. And so we really laid the work on the last group. So that, I think, is the answer to the question. I could talk about all the others, I suppose, but well, the most human interest one was the spider, Arabella. Unfortunately, she passed away after she got on the ground.
All right. So we do have a book signing that's starting here in just a few minutes. We can do one more rapid fire question really quick. Go ahead. What was that? Real quick, the question is, how did the body chemistry change in space? And Jack, if you want to take that one, if you can.
I think we have the doctors on board to talk about that one, I hope. Body chemistry, it took us a little while to get accustomed to being back in weightlessness and back in one gravity. And I'm not sure that there was any, I don't know much about the body chemistry getting back in space. One thing I do remember, though, is that when we got back in space, we looked like we were healthy sitting on the boat 2 days away from San Diego. And they put us in the infirmary, and they laid us out on these stretchers, you know, that have where you take a person to an emergency room on, an operating room on, had railings. And it came time to go to sleep. So they turned out the lights in the room. There's a door over in the corner, slightly open. That's the bathroom, the light on. In the middle of the night, I decided I had to go to the bathroom. So I grabbed a hold of those rails and floated myself, I thought, over to that door, and I didn't go anywhere. Well, it was natural for me to try to float over that door. And even after I got back home, 1 week later, I was in the bathroom shaving. I picked up my shaving lotion. I wanted to put it on my face. I tried to float it to the other side of my other hand, and it broke in the sink. So one of the things that stayed with us for a little while was some adaptation to being in zero gravity in a physical sort of way, I guess you might say. But you have to talk to the doctors and experimenters to see what was really different in our response to getting back to zero gravity.
Perfect. Thank you, sir. So real quick before everyone goes, thank you all for coming out. It's really amazing to hear the history of Skylab and how that's impacted what we've been doing now with the International Space Station and what NASA is going to be doing with the Artemis program as we go back to the moon. Real quick before you go, if you would like to do the book signing, it is over in the rotunda. I highly recommend picking up a copy of David's book. It is fantastic reading. So definitely do yourself a favor and snag one of those. Again, gentlemen, thank you for joining us today. It has been an honor to have you here.
Thank you.
And then in person, Emily and David as well. Thank you both for coming.
That's it for this episode of the Cosmosphere Podcast. We appreciate you listening. We would love to hear your feedback or questions, or if you have ideas for the show, please reach out to the Cosmosphere on social media and let us know what you think. We've got some exciting things lined up for this year, and we hope that you'll join us. Be sure to follow the Cosmosphere on social media. And as always, watch out on cosmo.org for the calendar of events at the Cosmosphere. All of those links will be in the show notes for this episode, so make sure to check those out. Follow along. We'd love to see you in person. For the Cosmosphere, I'm John Molnix. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you soon.